Good evening, one and all. I know another week is whizzing by. Anyway, this is Tuesday. This is me, Barry, with yet another book and a chat. About a month or so ago, we had somebody on the show written a book about the battles between Japan and America. And one of the things we found out was that surprised me that when you look at the sort of prison camps and the people, the prisoners that died in Europe with Germany, it's like 2.5 million. But when you look at Japan and that area, you're looking at more about 4.5 million. Tends to be forgotten. And though terrible though the atom bomb was, they reckon it saved millions and millions of lives, because as we heard on that and obviously other things, the Japanese would not have given up without a fight to the last sort of thing. Anyway, terrible though it was, what was it like to be there? What was it like if you actually lived through it? Well, my guest today, he can tell us a bit about that, because from his mother's memoirs, if you like, along with another person, written a book called Surviving Hiroshima or Hiroshima. I'm not sure which way we're going to talk, but I'll ask my guest when I get him on, because on the show today, I have the one and only Anthony Drago. Hi, Anthony. How are you doing?
Very well. How are you, Bill?
I am fine. So are we going to say Hiroshima or Hiroshima?
Well, I do both, but I've been saying Hiroshima.
Hiroshima. Okay, I will say that, because, as you say, people say two different ways. You've written this book along with Douglas Wellman, I believe, based a lot on your mother's memoirs. But the thing is, it didn't actually start in Japan, did it? It was, they actually escaped from Russia, didn't they, or something?
Yes, they did. They escaped. My mom was 3 months old and escaped from Russia by being carried out of there by her parents, my grandmother and grandfather.
Because, I mean, this is obviously during the revolution, the white Russian side. Her father, your grandfather, was a white Russian officer, but it wasn't easy to get out. They had to hijack a ship, didn't they?
They did. It was a cargo ship, and my grandfather with several other colleagues actually hijacked it, and they were armed, and they did get out of the port at Russia and to escape, yes.
But the thing is, much though it was, and they settled in Japan, they didn't realise, obviously, at the time, they were sort of almost out of the frying pan into the fire, because outbreak of World War II, there they were, in a strange country.
Right.
And their father was a musician, wasn't he?
Yes. He taught violin and cello, and he actually was employed. Early on, he was employed by the silent movie theater.
Oh, right.
In the very beginning, and most of them were, at that time, were all American movies, and he did the accompaniment of them. And later on, he was a instructor and started the school's orchestra, and that's how he made a living then.
But what happened when war broke out? I mean, was he treated with suspicion? Was he put under arrest or anything?
Well, when the war broke out, he wasn't immediate, but about 6-7 months later, the Japanese started, the government started getting suspicious of him because he's Caucasian, and
right.
he was stateless, and he was a Russian, and they did arrested him and put him in prison for about a year.
Now I know that we know that this it was sort of like the Eastern Front, shall I say, with Japan, and before that there was the wars with China that started and that sort of thing. But was there any sort of Russian move towards Japan, or were they strictly sort of in the European arena?
It was more of the European arena, but there was bad blood between Russia and Japan due to the Japanese-Russian war,
right,
conflict prior to that. So there was some bad blood or history there, but it wasn't per se continued on. They're pretty close together in the hemisphere, so there was a problem.
Right, because that's what I wondered, you know, because I mean, I've heard, you know, here we've had people on the show sort of about the internment camps in, you know, in America for Japanese or for Germans and stuff like that, and I wonder how bad it was for, you know, as you say, you know, a white Caucasian Russian, bit of bad blood there, to be in, you know, in Japan when the war broke out.
Well, when he was imprisoned, they were looking up, just like in the United States, were suspicious of Japanese in the United States in the internment camps. But there were very few families in Hiroshima during that time that were Caucasian. I think there were a total of five different Caucasian families, and they were Russian, happened to have been Russian. But when he was released after about 11, 12 months, and, you know, he went back to work, and they had to deal with the always being under, being carefully watched. But by the same token, they had to pull their weight in regards to making sure that there, you know, any bombing raids and such as that.
Right. But then, I mean, obviously, as the war went on, and it must have got worse for them, being, you know, everything that was going on on the war front and that.
Yes, and it was very strenuous for them emotionally, but that was pretty much for the whole city or the whole of Japan as being a citizen there, because you weren't the Japanese military and the government were not telling the truth about how the war was proceeding. They were told that you know, they were winning and they weren't, and how close the Americans were getting to Japan, doing their island hopping to the Japanese Empire. So it was very, very stressful.
I can imagine. Well, I can't imagine. It's beyond my imagination. Then, of course, you know, August 1945, and I think your mother was like 22 round about that time, everything changed.
Right. Everything changed. You know, when the bomb was released, my uncle, he was about 11, 12 years old. He was outside playing that morning, and he saw the B-29 coming over very, very high. And that wasn't really uncommon, because they were dropping leaflets for months before that. And he ran inside just to tell his parents what was going on, and he didn't even get the sentence out, and that's when the bomb detonated. It detonated 1,950 feet above ground level, and then everything just tumbled down.
Right. I mean, people think of the radiation stuff, but everything collapsed as well, didn't it? I mean, it's like the air had been taken out of the area, and everything just fell down.
Right. It just became a wasteland. And, I mean, you have the initial flash, my mom described it as, and then she was in the kitchen at the time, and then everything went flash bright, and then it went dark because everything collapsed around the family, and they were underneath all this debris. So, yeah, so everything just disappeared, basically.
And you know, leaving your mother and what was left of anybody, basically seeing devastation that nobody had ever seen before, you know, in this world, and perhaps since. And not just that, of course, nobody had seen the effects of radiation before, so it must have been hard to even know what to do.
Right, and you got to understand, their family home was a mile and a half from the epicenter, so they were very close. And you know, when everything disappeared, the first thing out of my, after they dug their way out, my grandfather, the first thing he noticed was he was able to see the ocean, where they never saw the ocean before. So that gives you an idea of how desolate everything was, and ash.
Right, I can imagine. I mean, I know, you know, your book, Surviving Hiroshima, does, you know, goes through this whole thing from the escape from Russia through to it. But it's yeah, people try and think, if you try and think, A, about managing to escape barely with your life from Russia, getting into a strange country, being treated with suspicion, your father put in prison, and then suddenly this devastation happens, and you have no idea what happened. There's nobody seen it before, nobody understood it or anything like that. It must, I mean, I know your mother sort of wrote a memoir sort of after and stuff like that, but it must be hard for people to even comprehend.
It is. And, you know, I was raised with this from a very young boy. I remember my mom telling me her upbringing in Japan. But she had a great upbringing. She had a great neighbors, great family life. Really, she was a learned the piano. She was good in sports, and she had a great life. And then the war started, and everything started to start going out of control, and with a lot of emotion. And then when the bomb hit, it was just like, oh, what else is going to happen?
Right. Well, what could happen? Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. And then they were on their own, and basically, either everybody else was, you know, injured or dead or disappeared, and they had to survive and walking barefoot down what they call a road that is all ash, and continued to the countryside a little bit to get out of town. And and then my mom working in the different field hospitals, because she felt the need to do that to help. So
the story,
there's a lot of things going on in this story, but the core of the story, it's about my mother's survival.
Right. Because not just surviving, but as you say, I mean, yeah, her trying to treat people in hospital for something that nobody had ever seen before, i.e. the radiation part of it. But then, of course, you know, obviously being, yeah, pretty good in English, she then sort of started working for the Americans, didn't she, as a later on?
Yes, she did. Family traveled to Tokyo and was hired because they were so good in English and translation from Japanese. My grandfather was in charge of being a manager for the officers' club at GHQ under General MacArthur, and my mom was translator and typist for the general headquarters of General MacArthur also.
Okay, so and yeah, all this time, I mean, this is something, I mean, I say, I know she sort of wrote a lot of this down afterwards and you sort of picked that up and it went through sort of other bits and pieces, other sort of American war correspondence and stuff like that to get more information. But it's something that must have stayed with her as a nightmare all her life.
Well, to be honest, my mom just put it behind her. Wow. After she got to the United States. She met my father, fell in love with my father in Tokyo. He was there during the occupation. And then when she got to the United States and got married to my dad, she just basically put it behind her. But you got to understand, this was after several years because she was also a wanted commodity by the press because she was the first survivor to ever set foot on in the United States, and that's Caucasian, and that you know, she was. They wanted her to talk about it. She was in a lot of newspapers, a lot of magazines, did a lot of radio interviews. So after that, it got, you know, it was quiet, and basically she wanted to raise her kids and have a family. So,
So I mean, was she sort of away from the epicenter? How did she survive?
Well, being a mile and a half.
Okay, you said a mile and a half, yeah.
Yeah, it was very, very close, and it's a miracle she survived. I mean, it really was, and everybody, because, you know, everybody was that was caught outside perished, and to be honest with you, I, looking back at all the research I've done on the atomic bomb, she should not be here.
Right.
She should not have survived it with the family, and I probably shouldn't be here. So I don't know really what to tell you. It's a miracle.
Right. Because I know, I remember, I think it was at school. I chose it a long while ago. There was somebody's story where they were the blast threw them into the swimming pool or something like that. And they survived because they were under the water or something at the time, that split second or something when it sort of went across, something like that. And you hear the odd thing and stuff like that. But I mean, basically, you know, a mile and a half, you'd have thought the fallout and stuff like that. And as you say, you know, the houses collapsed and everything around her. As you say, it's a bit of a miracle there.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Looking back, I mean, as you say, it's terrific that your mother was able to put it behind her, because you know, you'd have thought that with everything, but I guess, you know, the fact that she was involved with the after and interviews and stuff like that, it wasn't quite the same, like it festered, you know, in her mind. But when you came to start writing the book, did it shock you, some of the information you were able to get from her or get the information, you know, from other sources?
Well, it didn't really shock me because I was raised with this story. At different parts of my, you know, growing up, she told me different parts of it, whatever was appropriate, you know. But I always... I always thought that this needed to be told, and it wasn't till after I retired in 2006 from the police department that I actually said to myself, you know, if I don't do this, no one will.
Exactly.
So
yes.
I tried to say, well, I'm going to do this for my family. And that's how it started. And then it kind of evolved into this, you know what, this story is bigger than my family. This has to be told to people.
Yep.
Because in researching it, I started to get the feeling that it became clearer and clearer that there's so many things in this book and in this story that is very relative to today.
Mm-hmm.
not only the obvious of nuclear and, you know, North Korea, China, Iran, but in our relationships, but also about faith and family unity to try to get through adversity in life.
Indeed, very, very much so. And also going back to what you said about, you know, you thought it's times you needed to be written. This is not, you know, you're not the first person in the last couple of years that has come on with that thing and that feeling and that thought, because, you know, the sort of hand-me-down stories, if you don't tell them, it doesn't get handed down to the next generation very well these days. You know, it's the family sort of stories being handed down just doesn't happen. And it's right that you should, you know, share this. I mean, you know, your mother was a bit of a heroine, just to be honest, obviously, you know, working in that environment, working in the hospitals, you know, saving the family and everything like that. And then after the war and, you know, as you said, you know, appearing on a lot of interviews and stuff like that. Yeah, she needs to be remembered. And quite rightly, what you're saying, you know, what happened compared to these days needs to be mentioned.
Right. I totally agree. It just, you know, in writing the book, it just got bigger than just our family. It just, I really believe that, and I'm really excited to share it with the world.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as you say, it started off with just your family and you know, writing about what happened to your mother, grandparents, etc. But it's something that needs to be shared with a larger audience, very much so. Is there anything when you sort of, you know, you went through your mother's notes and everything like that that surprised you along the way?
Well, yeah, there was several things in my research and my reaching out to people that may have known my grandfather, because my grandfather, when he came to the United States, he ended up getting a employment as a Russian language teacher at the Army Language School in Monterey.
Uh-huh.
Well, I live in Monterey, so I've come full circle. And I remember being here with my grandfather numerous times. But what surprises me is some of the people, grandsons of people that either knew my mom,
mm-hmm.
or knew my uncle and remembered them. But this one particular person was a student, a Russian student officer, that actually learned Russian from my grandfather that served in the intelligence area, and he contacted me. So it was really enlightening to hear stories about my grandfather from people that I didn't know.
Right. Yeah, you don't realize how many people can get touched by a person, being a teacher, be it kindness or what have you, and the fact that they can still remember those people, you know, it just shows you some good things were thought about at the time.
Absolutely.
So, what sort of response have you had to the book so far?
We've had a really good response prior to release of the book. We got on the Facebook page, and we have about 2,500 followers Facebook, which is really good. We've had, it's only been probably a week or not even a little over a week since release on the first. And we've gotten really good reviews, all 5-star. So, you know, this is the first book I've ever done. Probably, I don't know, unless it's going to be a second phase of this book, but this is all new to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I think the people realize how important this book is when they start reading it, that it's a really important book for everyone to read.
Indeed so. The cover of the book, is that your mother on it, or is that just a random picture?
No, that's my mother at age 12. And I always like that picture because it represents her upbringing
right.
In Japan. And the mushroom cloud, I've always liked the black and white in front of the color. Mm. And that mushroom cloud was the description of the blast that was viewed by Sergeant Karen, George Karen, who is the tail gunner of the Enola Gay.
Right.
And he was the first one to actually see the and describe it, because he was in the tail mm-hmm. of the airplane while it was flying away from the blast.
Right.
Well, the reason that's so important to me is because my mother was interviewed and met George Karen after 1950 in New York during an interview, and I have pictures of that.
Yeah, very eye-catching, as you say, with the color of the red and gold and black of the mushroom cloud, and then the black and white picture of your mother in a kimono sort of kneeling at the front. Very eye-catching cover of that. Anyway, time is now beating us, Anthony, so what I'm going to do is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find out about your book and about you, of course.
Well, we have a website, and it's survivinghiroshima.com. We're on Facebook, and the public Facebook, and it's that's Surviving Hiroshima, A Young Woman's Story. I think you'd really enjoy that. The book could be purchased Amazon, Apple Books, and also Barnes & Noble, or you could request it at your local bookstore.
That's great. Well, Anthony, I'm sure it's a book that loads of people will find very interesting, as you say, in this world today, perhaps enlightening as well. So thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate this, Barry. And I hope everybody enjoys the book.
Indeed so. Well, there you go. My guest today, Anthony Drago, who, along with Douglas Wellman, has written this book based on his mother's memoirs, basically, Kaleria Palchikov. Hope that's right. Anyway, and it's called Surviving Hiroshima, which basically about a young Russian girl, her family escaped from Russia during the Russian Revolution, the White Russians, they were, captured a boat, escaped to Japan, settled in Japan, and all the, not many Caucasians there, and obviously, I guess, taller than a lot of the Japanese there at the time and everything, and then lived through the bomb going off, the H-bomb going off, and afterwards moving to America and sort of following up with that. Terrific book, very enlightening, and I'm sure a lot of people will really enjoy it. Well, that's it for now. I will be back tomorrow with a fresh guest, hopefully. But until then, as always, I have one thing left to say. Don't forget. Make sure it's working.